A tooled-up General Systems vehicle was a supremely powerful fighting machine, easily outgunning any single unit on the Iderian side. But it was not just inherently less flexible as an instrument of war compared to a fleet of smaller craft, it was also unique in the binary nature of its survivability. If a fleet ran into serious trouble, usually some of its ships could run away to fight another day. But a similarly beset GSV either triumphed or suffered total destruction, at its own behest, if not because of the actions of the enemy. Just the contemplation of a loss on such a magnitude was sufficient to give the strategic planning minds of the Culture's war command the equivalent of ulcers, sleepless nights, and general conniptions. In one of the more desperate of those engagements, buying time while a group of Culture orbitals was readied for flight and slowly accelerated to a velocity sufficient to ensure the world's escape from the volume of space under threat, the lasting damage had thrown itself into a particularly wild and dangerous environment, deep inside the blossoming sphere of Iderian hegemony. Before it had departed on what most concerned, including itself, thought would be its last mission, it had, as a matter of course, transmitted its mind state, effectively its soul, to another GSV, which then sent the recording onwards to another Culture mind on the far side of the galaxy, where it might be held, dormant, and safe. Then, along with a few subsidiary units, barely meriting the name warships, more like semi-devolved powered weapon pods, it set off on its raid, climbing up and out above the lens of the galaxy on a high, curving course, hooked above the swell of stars like a claw. The lasting damage plunged into the web of Iderian supply, logistic support, and reinforcement routes, like a berserk raptor thrown into a nest of hibernating kittens, devastating and disrupting all it could find in an erratic series of pulverizingly murderous full-speed attacks. Spread throughout centuries of space, the Iderians had thought long since swept free of Culture ships. It had been agreed that there would be no communication from the GSV unless by some miracle it made it back into the rapidly withdrawing sphere of Culture influence. The only sign that reached its comrade craft that it had escaped immediate detection and destruction was that the pressure on the units remaining behind to resist the direct thrust of the Iderian battle fleets lessened appreciably, as enemy vessels were either intercepted before they reached the front, or diverted from it to deal with the emerging threat. Then there came rumours, through some of the refugee craft of neutrals fleeing the hostilities, of a knot of Iderian fleets swarming round a volume of space near a recent raid location, on the very outskirts of the galaxy, followed by a furious battle, culminating in a gigantic annihilatory explosion, whose signature, when it was finally picked up and analysed, was exactly that produced when a beleaguered military GSV of the Culture had had time to orchestrate a maximally extraneously damaging destruct sequence. News of the battle, and the GSV's martial success and final sacrifice, was headlining main menu stuff for less than a day. The war, like the Iderian battle fleets, swept onwards, burgeoning with distraction and ruse, incident and havoc, horror and spectacle. Gradually, the Culture implemented its shift to full-scale war production. The Iderians, already slowed by the commitments they had had to make to control the colossal volumes of their newly conquered territories, found the pace of their advance faltering in places. Initially through their own inability to bring the requisite combat apparatus to bear, but increasingly due to the growing ability of the Culture to push back as whole fleets of new warships were produced and dispatched by the Culture's orbital manufactories far away from the war. New evidence of the destruction of the GSV lasting damage and the Iderian war vessels it had taken with it came in from a neutral ship of another involved species, which had passed near the battle site. The stored personality of the lasting damage was duly resurrected from the mind it had been stored with and emplaced into another craft of the same class. It joined, rejoined, the encompassing struggle, thrown into battle after battle, never knowing which might be its last, and holding within itself all the memories of its earlier incarnation, intact right up until the instant it had cast off its fields and set its looping trajectorial course for Ideran space a full year earlier. There was just one complication. The lasting damage, the original ship mind, had not been destroyed. As a GSV, it had struggled to the end and fought to the last, dutifully, determinedly, and without thought for its own safety. But finally, as an individual mind, it had escaped in one of its slaved weapon pods. Having suffered its due portion of the profoundly focused attentions of not one, but several Ideran war fleets, the not-quite-warship was by then little more than a wreck. A not-quite-not-quite warship. Thrown from the erupting energies of the self-destructing GSV, flung out of the main body of the galaxy with barely sufficient energy to maintain its own fabric, it flew above and away from the plane of the galaxy. More like a gigantic piece of shrapnel than any sort of ship. Largely disarmed, mostly blind, entirely dumb, and not daring to use its all-too-rough and barely-ready engines for fear of detection until, at length, it had no choice. Even then, it turned them on for only the minimum amount of time necessary to stop itself colliding with the energy grid between the universes. If the Ideerans had had more time, they would have searched for any surviving fragments of the GSV, and probably they would have found the castaway. As it was, there had been more pressing matters to attend to. By the time anybody thought to double-check that the GSV's destruction had been as complete as it had first appeared, the half-ruined vessel, now millennia distant from the upper limit of the great disk of stars that was the galaxy, was just about far enough away to escape detection. Gradually, it had started to repair itself. Hundreds of days passed. Eventually, it risked using its much-worked-upon engines to start tugging it towards the regions of space where it hoped the culture still held sway. Uncertain who was where, it abstained from signaling until, at last, it arrived back in the galaxy proper, in a region which it was reasonably confident must still be outside Ideran control. The signal announcing its arrival caused some confusion at first, but a GSV rendezvoused with it and took it aboard. It was informed it had a twin. It was the first but not the last time something like this would happen during the war, despite all the care the culture took to confirm the deaths of its minds. The original mind was re-emplaced in another newly built GSV and took the name Lasting Damage 1. The successor ship renamed itself Lasting Damage 2. They became part of the same battle fleet, following their mutual request, and fought together through another 4 decades of war. Near the end, they were both present when the Battle of the Twin Novae took place, in the region of space known as Arm 1-6. One survived, the other perished. They had swapped mind states before the battle began. The survivor incorporated the soul of the destroyed ship into its own personality, as they had agreed. It, too, was almost annihilated in the fighting, and again had to take to a smaller craft to save both itself and the salvaged soul of its twin. "Which one died?" Zilla asked. "One or two?" The Avatar gave a small, diffident smile. "We were close together at the time when it happened, and it was all very confused. I was able to conceal who died and who survived for a good many years, until somebody did the relevant detective work. It was two who was killed. One who lived." The creature shrugged. "It didn't matter. It was only the fabric of the craft housing the substrate which was destroyed, and the body of the surviving ship met the same fate. The result was the same as it would have been the other way round. Both minds became the one mind, became me. The avatar seemed to hesitate, then gave a dainty little bow. Zilla watched the orbital race by overhead. Car lines whipped past, almost too fast to follow. Only the vaguest impressions of actual cars, even in long trains, were visible, unless they were moving in the same direction as the module appeared to be. Then they seemed to move more slowly for a while, before drawing away, pulling ahead, falling behind, or curving away to either side.
I imagine the situation must have been confused indeed, if you were able to hide who died, Zilla said.
It was pretty bad, the avatar agreed lightly. It was watching the orbital undersurface whiz by with a vague smile on its face. The way war tends to be.
What was it made you want to become a hub mind?
You mean beyond the urge to settle down and do something constructive, after all those decades spent hurtling across the galaxy destroying things?
Yes.
The avatar turned to face him. I'd have to assume you've done your research here, Curzilla.
I do know a little of what happened. Just think of me as old-fashioned enough, or primitive enough, to like hearing things straight from the person who was there.
I had to destroy an orbital, Zilla. In fact, I had to blitz 3 in a single day.
Well, war is hell.
The avatar looked at him, as though trying to decide whether the Chelgrian was trying too hard to make light of the situation. As I said, the events are all entirely a matter of public record.
I take it there was no real choice?
Indeed. That was the judgment I had to act upon.
Your own?
Partially. I was part of the decision-making process, though even if I disagreed, I might still have acted as I did. That's what strategic planning is there for.
It must be a burden, not even being able to say you were just obeying orders.
Well, that is always a lie. Or a sign you are fighting for an unworthy cause, or still have a very long way to develop civilizationally.
A terrible waste. 3 orbitals? A responsibility?
The avatar shrugged. An orbital is just unconscious matter, even if it does represent a lot of effort and expended energy. Their minds were already safe, long gone. The human deaths were what I found affecting.
Did many people die?
3,492.
Out of how many?
310 million.
A small proportion.
It's always 100% for the individual concerned.
Still...
No. No still, the avatar said, shaking its head. Light slid across its silver skin.
How did the few 100 million survive?
Shipped out, mostly. About 20% were evacuated in underground cars. They work as lifeboats. There are lots of ways to survive. You can move whole orbitals if you have the time, or you can ship people out, or, short-term, use underground cars or other transport systems, or just suits. On very few occasions, entire orbitals have been evacuated by storage transmission. The human bodies were left inert after their mind states were zapped away, though that doesn't always save you, if the storing substrate slagged too before it can transmit onwards.
And the ones who didn't get away?
All knew the choice they were making. Some had lost loved ones. Some were, I suppose, mad, but nobody was sure enough to deny them their choice. Some were old and or tired of life, and some left it too late to escape, either corporeally or by zapping after watching the fun, or something went wrong with their transport or mind state record or transmission. Some held beliefs that caused them to stay. The avatar fixed its gaze on Zilla's. Save for the ones who experienced equipment malfunctions, I recorded every one of those deaths, Zilla. I didn't want them to be faceless. I didn't want to be able to forget.
That was ghoulish, wasn't it?
Call it what you want. It was something I felt I had to do. War can alter your perceptions, change your sense of values. I didn't want to feel that what I was doing was anything other than momentous and horrific. Even, in some first principles sense, barbaric. I sent drones, micro-missiles, camera platforms, and bugs down to those three orbitals. I watched each of those people die. Some went in less than the blink of an eye, obliterated by my own energy weapons, or annihilated by the warheads I'd displaced. Some took only a little longer, incinerated by the radiation or torn to pieces by the blast fronts. Some died quite slowly, thrown tumbling into space to cough blood which turned to pink ice in front of their freezing eyes, or found themselves suddenly weightless as the ground fell away beneath their feet and the atmosphere around them lifted off into the vacuum like a tent caught in a gale, so that they gasped their way to death. Most of them I could have rescued. The same displacers I was using to bombard the place could have sucked them off it. And as a last resort, my effectors might have plucked their mind states from their heads, even as their bodies froze or burned around them. There was ample time.
But you left them?
Yes.
And watched them?
Yes.
Still, it was their choice to stay.
Indeed.
And did you ask their permission to record their death throes?
No. If they would hand me the responsibility for killing them, they could at least indulge me in that. I did tell all concerned what I would be doing beforehand. That information saved a few. It did attract criticism, though. Some people felt it was insensitive.
And what did you feel?
Appalled, compassion, despair, detached, elated, godlike, guilty, horrified, miserable, pleased, powerful, responsible, soiled, sorrowful,
elated, pleased.
Those are the closest words. There is an undeniable elation in causing mayhem, in bringing about such massive destruction. As for feeling pleased, I felt pleasure that some of those who died did so because they were stupid enough to believe in gods or afterlives that do not exist, even though I felt a terrible sorrow for them as they died in their ignorance and thanks to their folly. I felt pleasure that my weapon and sensory systems were working as they were supposed to. I felt pleasure that despite my misgivings, I was able to do my duty and act as I had determined a fully morally responsible agent ought to in the circumstances.
And all this makes you suitable to command a world of 50 billion souls?
Perfectly, the Avatar said smoothly. I have tasted death, Zilla. When my twin and I merged, we were close enough to the ship being destroyed to maintain a real-time link to the substrate of the mind within, as it was torn apart by the tidal forces produced by a line gun. It was over in a microsecond, but we felt it die bit by bit, area by distorted area, memory by disappearing memory, all kept going until the absolute bitter end by the ingenuity of mind design. Falling back, stepping down, closing off, and retreating and regrouping and compressing and abandoning and abstracting and finessing, always trying by whatever means possible to keep its personality, its soul, intact, until there was nothing remaining to sacrifice, nowhere else to go, and no survival strategies left to apply. It leaked away to nothingness in the end, pulled to pieces until it just dissolved into a mist of subatomic particles and the energy of chaos. The last two coherent things it held onto were its name and the need to maintain the link that communicated all that was happening to it, from it to us. We experienced everything it experienced. All its bewilderment and terror, each iota of anger and pride, every last nuance of grief and anguish. We died with it. It was us, and we were it. And so, you see, I have already died, and I can remember and replay the experience in perfect detail any time I wish. The Avatar smiled silkily as it leant closer to him, as though imparting a confidence. Never forget, I am not this silver body, Marai. I am not an animal brain. I am not even some attempt to produce an AI through software running on a computer. I am a culture mind. We are close to gods, and on the far side. We are quicker. We live faster and more completely than you do, with so many more senses, such a greater store of memories, and at such a fine level of detail. We die more slowly, and we die more completely, too. Never forget, I have had the chance to compare and contrast the ways of dying. It looked away for a moment. The orbital streamed past above their heads. Nothing stayed in sight for longer than the blink of an eye. The underground car tracks were blurs. The impression of speed was colossal. Zilla looked down. The stars appeared now to be stationary. He had done the maths in his head before they entered the module. Their speed, relative to the orbital, was now about 110 kilometers per second. Long-range express car trains would still be overtaking them. The module would take an entire day to circle the world hovering here, while Hub's travel time guarantee was no more than 2 hours from any express port to any other, and a 3-hour journey from any given subplate access point to another. I have watched people die in exhaustive and penetrative detail, the Avatar continued. I have felt for them. Did you know that true subjective time is measured in the minimum duration of demonstrably separate thoughts? Per second, a human, or a Chelgrim, might have 20 or 30, even in the heightened state of extreme distress associated with the process of dying in pain. The Avatar's eyes seemed to shine. It came forward, closer to his face by the breadth of a hand. Whereas I, it whispered, have billions. It smiled, and something in its expression made Zilla clench his teeth. I watched those poor wretches die in the slowest of slow motion, and I knew even as I watched that it was I who'd killed them, who was at that moment engaged in the process of killing them. For a thing like me to kill one of them or one of you is a very, very easy thing to do. And, as I discovered, absolutely disgusting. Just as I need never wonder what it is like to die, so I need never wonder what it is like to kill, Zilla, because I have done it. And it is a wasteful, graceless, worthless, and hateful thing to have to do. And, as you might imagine, I consider that I have an obligation to discharge. I fully intend to spend the rest of my existence here as Masak Hub, for as long as I'm needed or until I'm no longer welcome, forever keeping an eye to windward for approaching storms, and just generally protecting this quaint circle of fragile little bodies and the vulnerable little brains they house, from whatever harm a big, dumb, mechanical universe or any consciously malevolent force might happen or wish to visit upon them, specifically because I know how appallingly easy they are to destroy. I will give my life to save theirs, if it should ever come to that, and give it gladly, happily too, knowing that the trade was entirely worth the debt I incurred 800 years ago, back in Arm 1-6. The Avatar stepped back, smiled broadly, and tipped its head to one side. It suddenly looked, Zilla thought, as though it might as well have been discussing a banquet menu or the positioning of a new underground access tube. Any other questions, Kurzilla? He looked at it for a moment or two. Yes, he said. He held up his pipe. May I smoke in here? The Avatar stepped forward, put one arm round his shoulders, and with its other hand clicked its fingers. A blue-yellow flame sprang from its index finger. Be my guest. Above their heads, in a matter of seconds, the orbital slowed to a stop, while beneath their feet, the stars started to revolve once again. Chapter 14. Returning to Leave, Recalling Forgetting. How many will die? Perhaps 10%. That is the calculation. So that would be 5 billion? Yes. That is about what we lost. That is the approximate number of souls barred from the beyond by the catastrophe visited upon us by the culture. That is a great responsibility, Asterion. It is mass murder, Major, Biskile said with a humorless smile. Is that what you were thinking? It is revenge, a balancing, and it is still mass murder, Major. Let us not mince our words. Let us not hide behind euphemisms. It is mass murder of non-combatants, and as such, illegal according to the galactic agreements we are signatory to. Nevertheless, we believe it is a necessary act. We are not barbarians. We are not insane. We would not dream of doing something so awful, even to aliens, if it had not become obvious that it had become, through the actions of those same aliens, something which had to be done to rescue our own people from limbo. There can be no doubt that the culture owes us those lives. But it is still an appalling act even to be contemplating. The Astodien sat forward and grasped one of Quillen's hands in his. Major Quillen, if you have changed your mind, if you are beginning to reconsider, tell us now. Do you still have the taste for this? Quillen looked into the old male's eyes. One death is an appalling thing to contemplate, Astodien. Of course. And 5 billion lives seems an unreal number, does it not? Yes. Unreal. And do not forget, the gone before have read you, Quillen. They have looked inside your head and know what you are capable of better than you do yourself. They pronounced you clear. Therefore they must be certain that you will do what must be done, even if you feel doubts about that yourself. Quillen lowered his gaze. That is comforting, Astrodian. It is disturbing, I would have thought. Perhaps that a little too. Perhaps a person who might be called a confirmed civilian would be more disturbed than comforted. I am still a soldier, Estudien. Knowing that I will do my duty is no bad thing. Good, Viskile said, letting go Quillen's hand and sitting back. Now, we begin again. He stood up. Come with me. It was 4 days after they'd arrived in the airsphere. Quillen had spent most of that time within the chamber containing the temple ship Soulhaven with Viskile. He sat or lay in the spherical cavity that was the innermost recessional space of the Soulhaven, while the Astodien attempted to teach him how to use the Soulkeeper's displacer function. The range of the device is only 14 meters, Viskile told him on the first day. They sat in the darkness, surrounded by a substrate holding millions of the dead. The shorter the leap, and of course the smaller the size of the object being displaced, the less power is required, and the less likelihood there is of the action being detected. 14 meters should be quite sufficient for what is required. What is it I'm trying to send, to displace? Initially, one of a stock of 20 dummy warheads, which were loaded into your soul keeper before it was emplaced within you. When the time comes for you to fire in anger, you will be manipulating the transference of one end of a microscopic wormhole, though without the wormhole attached. That sounds bizarre, to say the least, nevertheless. So, it's not a bomb. No. Though the eventual effect will be somewhat similar. Ah, Quinlan said. So, once the displacement has taken place, I just walk away. Initially, yes. Quillan could just make out the Estodien looking at him. Why, Major, were you expecting that to be the moment of your death? Yes, I was. That would be too obvious, Major. This was described to me as being a suicide mission, Estodien. I would hate to think I might survive it and feel cheated. How annoying that it is so dark in here. I can't see the expression on your face as you say that, Major. I am quite serious, Estodien. Probably just as well. Well, let me put your mind at rest, Major. You will assuredly die when the wormhole activates. Instantaneously. I hope that doesn't conflict with any desire you might have harbored for a lingering demise. The fact will be enough, Estodien. The manner is not something I can bring myself to be concerned with, though I would prefer it to be quick rather than slow. Quick it will be, Major. You have my word on that. So, Estodien, where do I carry out this displacement? Inside the hub of Massark Orbital, the space station which sits in the middle of the world. Is that normally accessible? Of course. Quillan, they run school trips there, so their young can see the place where the machine squats that oversees their pampered lives. Quillan heard the older male gather his robes about him. You simply ask to be shown round. It will not seem in the least suspicious. You carry out the displacement and return to the surface of the orbital. At the appointed time, the wormhole mouth will be connected with the wormhole itself. The hub will be destroyed. The orbital will continue to run using other automatic systems situated on the perimeter, but there will be some loss of life as particularly critical processes are left to run out of control, transport systems largely. Those souls stored in the hub's own substrates will be lost too. At any given moment, those stored souls can number over 4 billion. These will account for the majority of the lives the Chelgrian Puen require to release our own people into heaven. Quillan, thoughts? The words rang suddenly in his head, making him flinch. He sensed Viskile go quiet beside him. Gone before, he thought, and bowed his head. Just one thought, really. The obvious one. Why not let our dead into the beyond without this terrible action? Heroes, heaven! Honoring killed by enemies without reply, disgraces all come before, many more. Disgrace assumed when war believed our fault. Own responsibility. Accept disgrace. Accept disgraced. Know now, war caused by others. Fault theirs, disgrace theirs, responsibility theirs, debt theirs, rejoice. Now disgraced become heroes too, once balance of loss achieved. It is hard for me to rejoice, knowing that I will have so much blood on my hands. You go to oblivion, Quillan. Your wish. Blood not on you, but on memory of you. That restricted to few, if mission wholly succeeds. Think actions leading to mission, not results. Results, you're not concern. Other questions? No. No other questions, thank you. Think of the cup. Think of the interior of the cup. Think of the space of air that is the shape of the inside of the cup. Then think of the cup. Then think of the table. Then of the space around the table. Then of the route you would take from here to the table, to sit down at the table and take up the cup. Think of the act of moving from here to there. Think of the time it would take to move from this place to that place. Think of walking from where you are now to where the cup was when you saw it a few moments ago. Are you thinking of that, Quillan? Yes. Send. There was a pause. Have you sent? No, Estodian. I don't think so. Nothing has happened. We will wait. Anur is sitting by the table, watching the cup. You might have sent the object without knowing it. They sat a few moments longer. Then Viskile sighed and said, Think of the cup. Think of the interior of the cup. Think of the space of air that is the shape of the inside of the cup. I will never do this, Estodian. I can't send the damn thing anywhere. Maybe the Soul Keeper is broken. I do not think so. Think of the cup. Don't be disheartened, Major. Come now, eat. My people come from Sisa originally. There's an old Sison saying that the soup of life is salty enough without adding tears to it. They were in the Soulhaven's small refectory, at a table apart from the handful of other monks, whose watch schedule meant it was their lunchtime too. They had water, bread, and meat soup. Quillan was drinking his water from the plain white ceramic cup he had been using as a displacement target all morning. He stared into it morosely. I do worry, Estodian. Perhaps something has gone wrong. Perhaps I don't have the right sort of imagination or something. I don't know. Quillan, we are attempting to do something no Cheldrian has ever done before. You're trying to turn yourself into a Cheldrian displacement machine. You can't expect to get it right first time on the first morning you try it. Viskile looked up as Anur, the gangly monk who had shown them round the Behemothor's exterior the day they had arrived, passed their table with his tray. He bowed clumsily, nearly tipping the contents of his tray onto the floor, only just saving it. He gave a foolish smile. Viskile nodded. Anur had been sitting watching the cup all morning, waiting for a tiny black speck, possibly preceded by a tiny silver sphere, to appear in its white scoop. Viskile must have read Quillan's expression. I asked Anur not to sit with us. I don't want you to think of him sitting looking at the cup. I want you to think only of the cup. Quillan smiled. Do you think I might displace the test object into Anur by mistake? I doubt that would happen, though you never know.
But in any event, if you start to see Anur sitting there, tell me, and we'll replace him with one of the other monks. If I did displace the object into a person, what would happen? As I understand it, almost certainly nothing. The object is too small to cause any damage. I suppose if it materialized inside the person's eye, they might see a speck, or if it appeared right alongside a pain receptor, they might feel a tiny pinprick. Anywhere else in the body, it would go unnoticed. If you could displace this cup, the Estonian said, lifting his own ceramic cup, identical to Quillen's, into somebody's brain, then I dare say their head might explode, just from the pressure produced by the sudden extra volume. But the dummy warheads you are working with are too small to be noticed. It might block a small blood vessel. A capillary, perhaps. Nothing large enough to cause any tissue damage. Quillen drank from his own cup, then held it up, looking at it. I shall see this damn thing in my dreams. Iskile smiled. That might be no bad thing. Quillen supped his soup. What's happened to you, Eol? I haven't seen him since we arrived. Oh, he is about, Iskile said. He is making preparations. To do with my training? No, for when we leave. When we leave, Iskile smiled. All in due time, Major. And the two drones, our allies? As I said, all in good time, Major. And send? Yes. Yes? No. No, I hoped. Well, it doesn't matter. Let's try again. Think of the cup. Think of a place you know or knew well. A small place. Perhaps a room, or a small apartment or house. Perhaps the interior of a cabin, a car, a ship, anything. It must be a place you knew well enough to be able to find your way around at night, so that you knew where everything was in the darkness, and would not trip over things or break them. Imagine being there. Imagine going to a particular place and dropping, say, a crumb or a small bead or seed into a cup or other container. That night, he again found it difficult to sleep. He lay looking into the darkness, curled on the broad sleeping platform, breathing in the sweet, spicy air of the giant, bulbous, fruit-like thing where he, Viskile, and most of the others were billeted. He tried thinking about that damn cup, but gave up. He was tired of it. Instead, he tried to work out exactly what was going on here. It was obvious, he thought, that the technology inside the specially adapted soul keeper he had been fitted with was not Chelgrian. Some other involved was taking a part in this. An involved species whose technology was on a par with the cultures. Two of their representatives were probably housed inside the pair of double cone-shaped drones he'd seen earlier, the ones who had spoken to him inside his head, before the gone before had. They had not reappeared. He supposed the drones might be remotely operated, perhaps from somewhere outside the air sphere. Though the Oskandari's notorious antipathy towards such technology meant that the drones probably did physically contain the aliens. Equally, that made it all the more puzzling that the air sphere had been chosen as the place to train him in the use of a technology as advanced as that contained within his soul keeper. Unless the idea was that if the use of such devices escaped attention here, it would also go unnoticed in the culture.
This ends side two of cassette 8 of Look to Windward.